And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, if you're thinking about stocking up for Christmas, we went to several grocery stores the last few days and none of them had any turkeys. I mean, none. So if you, we were even out on post at the commissary. No turkeys. Now, some of the senior officers are real turkeys, but that's another story. All right, today's December the 2nd, 336th day of the year. 29 days remain till the year's over with. In the year 1244, Pope Innocent IV, and he was not innocent by any means, arrives at Lyon for the First Council of Lyon. 1409, University of Leipzig opens up. 1697, St. Paul's Cathedral, rebuilt to the design of Sir Christopher Wren following the Great Fire of London, is consecrated. Yes, let's wave our hands and sprinkle some water, and it's holy. 1763, dedication of the Truro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island. That's the first synagogue in which they'll come to the United States. 1766, Swedish Parliament approves the Swedish Freedom of the Press Act, implements it as a ground law, thus being first in the world with freedom of speech, which has been taken away here by the great and powerful Fauci and his little puppet, Biden. 1804 at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, Napoleon Bonaparte crowns himself Emperor of the French. 1805, War of the Third Coalition, the Battle of Austerlitz. French troops under Napoleon decisively defeat a joint Russo-Austrian army. 1823, Monroe Doctrine. In a State of the Union message, President James Monroe proclaims American neutrality in future European conflicts and warns the European powers not to interfere in the Americas, as if they particularly cared what he said. 1845, Manifest Destiny. In a State of the Union message, President James K. Polk proposes the U.S. should aggressively expand to the West, which was news to the Native Americans. 1848, Franz Joseph I becomes the Emperor of Austria. 1851, French President Louis Napoleon Bonaparte overthrows the Second Republic. 1852, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte becomes Emperor of the French as Napoleon III. 1859, militant abolitionist leader John Brown is hung for his October 16th raid on Harper's Ferry in West Virginia. Commander of the U.S. troops that routed him out was Robert E. Lee. 1865, Alabama ratifies the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, followed by North Carolina, then Georgia. U.S. slaves were legally free within 2 weeks. 1867, at Tremont Temple in Boston, British author Charles Dickens gives his first public reading in the U.S. 1899, Philippine-American War. The Battle of Triad Pass, known as the Filipino Thermopylae, is fought. In that particular battle, 60-man Filipino rear guard commanded by Brigadier General Gregorio de Pilar succumbed to more than 500 Americans, mostly the 33rd Volunteer Infantry Regiment under Major Peyton March. But they did delay the American advance to ensure President Emilio Aguinaldo and his troops escaped. Now, the retreat of Aguinaldo from Bayambang through the mountainous terrain began November 13, 1899. He had disbanded the regular Filipino army into guerrilla units. On November 23rd, his party reached the pass, which provided a strategic bottleneck. It was to be protected by a rear guard under General Del Pilar, who noticed the advantageous terrain of Triad Pass.
and he hunkered down to defend it while Aguinaldo escaped through the mountains. He had a hand-picked force of Filipinos. The remaining contingent of the late Antonio Luna's army. And they built trenches and stone barricades on both shoulders of the pass. Well, they did what they viewed as a heroic stand. 1908, Puyi becomes Emperor of China at the age of 2. He was also the last Emperor of China. He ruled during the imperial period of Chinese history. He was considered the son of heaven and the autocrat of all under heaven. Under the Han Dynasty, Confucianism replaced legalism as the official political theory, and succession theoretically followed the agnatic primogeniture. Succession of emperors in a paternal family line constituted a dynasty. Now, the absolute authority of the emperor came with a variety of governing duties and moral obligations. And if you didn't uphold them, you could be was thought to remove the dynasty's mandate of heaven and justify its overthrow. In practice, it didn't quite work out that way. 1917, World War I. Russia and the Central Powers signed an armistice at Brest-Litovsk. Peace talks leading to the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk begin. 1927, following 19 years of Model T Ford production, the Ford Motor Company unveils the Ford Model A as its new automobile. 1930, Great Depression. In a State of the Union message, President Herbert Hoover proposes a $150 million public works program to help generate jobs and stimulate the economy. 1939, New York City's LaGuardia Airport opens up. 1942, World War II. During the Manhattan Project, a team led by Enrico Fermi initiates the first artificial self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction. 1943, World War II. A Luftwaffe bombing raid on the harbor of Bari, Italy sinks numerous cargo and transport ships, including the American ship SS John Harvey, which is carrying a stockpile of World War I era mustard gas. Bit of a kerfluffle on that. 1947, the Jerusalem riots of 47. Riots break out in Jerusalem in response to the United Nations partition plan for Palestine. 1949, Convention for the Suppression of the Traffic in Persons and Exploitation of the Prostitution of Others is adopted. For all the good it did. 1950, Korean War. The Battle of Chongchan River ends with a decisive Chinese victory and the UN forces are completely expelled from North Korea. 1954, Cold War. The U.S. Senate votes 65-22 to censure Joseph McCarthy for conduct tends to bring the Senate into dishonor and disrepute. Under that particular standard, they ought to try every member of the Senate. And some of them twice. 1954, the Sino-American Mutual Defense Treaty between the U.S. and Taiwan is signed in Washington, D.C. Biden is getting ready to breach. 1956, the Granma reaches the shores of Cuba's Orient Province. Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and 80 other members of the 26th of July movement disembark to initiate the Cuban Revolution. 1957, United Nations Security Council Resolution 126 relating to the Kashmir conflict is adopted. 1961, in a nationally broadcast speech, Fidel Castro declares he's a Marxist-Leninist and Cuba's going to adopt communism. Now, that came as a great surprise to a lot of people, but 1962, Vietnam War. After a trip to Vietnam, At the request of President Kennedy, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield becomes the first American official to comment adversely on the war's progress. 1970, United States Environmental Protection Agency begins operations. 1971, Abu Dhabi, Ajman, Fujairah, Sharjah, Dubai, and Umm Al Quwam formed the United Arab Emirates. 1975, Laotian Civil War. The Pathet Lao seizes the Laotian capital of Vientiane, forcing the abdication of King Sisavang Vatana, and proclaims the Lao People's Democratic Republic. 1976, Fidel Castro becomes president of Cuba, replacing Osvaldo Dorcacos Torrado. 1980, Salvadoran Civil War. Four American missionaries are raped and murdered by a death squad. Now, ordinarily, that would be against the law, but it wasn't. 1982, University of Utah. Barney Clark becomes the first person to get a permanent artificial heart. 1988, Benazir Bhutto, sworn in as Prime Minister of Pakistan, becomes the first woman to head the government of a Muslim-majority state. 1989, the peace agreement of Hat Yai is signed and ratified by the Malayan Communist Party and the governments of Malaysia and Thailand, ending the over two-decade-long communist insurgency in Malaysia. 1991, Canada and Poland become the first nations to recognize independence of Ukraine from the Soviet Union. 1993, Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar shot and killed in Medellin. Also in 93, Space Shuttle Program, STS-61. NASA launches the Space Shuttle Endeavor on a mission to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. 1999, UK devolves political power in Northern Ireland to the Northern Ireland Executive that follows the Good Friday Agreement. 2001, Enron files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. One of the biggest bankruptcy cases in history. 2015, San Bernardino attack. Syed, Rizwan, Farouk, and Tashfin Malik kill 14 and wound 22 at the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino, California. 2016, 36 people died of fire at a converted Oakland, California warehouse, which was serving as an artist collective. Basically a flop house. 2020, the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs removes cannabis from the list of the most dangerous drugs in the single convention on narcotic drugs. Everybody's suddenly in favor of marijuana. Well, I find that interesting. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. In Cuba, it's Armed Forces Day. Christian Feast Day, Avitus of Rouen, Bibiana, Channing Moore Williams in the Anglican Church, Chromatius, Habakkuk in the Eastern Orthodox Church, Nonus, International Day for the Abolition of Slavery in the United Nations, which is going on like you wouldn't believe, Lao National Day, and in the United Arab Republics, it is National Day. Let's see what else we got. In 1620, the English language newspaper Nam Luce begins publishing in Amsterdam. 1682, Anthony Ashley Cooper, first Earl of Shaftesbury, flees to Amsterdam following the failure of his plot to prevent a Catholic succession should King Charles II die. 1755, the second Eddystone Lighthouse on Eddystone Rocks off the English southern coast is destroyed by fire. 1777, British General Howe plots attacks on Washington's army for December the 4th. 1790, Austrian army occupies Brussels. 1802, Britain sells Suriname to the Netherlands.
1812, James Madison reelected president of the U.S. Elbridge Gerry is vice president. 1813, Prince Wilhelm Frederick accepts a constitutional monarchy. 1816, the first savings bank in the U.S. opens. That's the Philadelphia Savings Fund Society. 1822, in San Salvador, a Congress proposes incorporation into the U.S. 1840, William Henry Harrison is elected the 9th president of the U.S. He was a former general. 1864, on this date, there was a skirmish at Rocky Creek Church in Georgia. 1891, the 52nd Congress convenes. 1899, U.S. and Germany agreed to divide Samoa. 1900, the exiled South African president of Transvaal, Paul Kruger, arrives in Germany. He was the third president of the South African Republic. Kaiser refused to meet with him. 1901, King Gillette began selling safety razor blades. The company he started is Gillette, which has gone woke and says it can, if people do what it said, this will be a better world. 1913. We got the Archdiocese of Managua created on this date in 1913. 1914, the Austrian army occupies Belgrade in Serbia. 1917, Hang Wong Woon found Zen awakening at Osean Monastery in Korea. 1927, the first Model A Ford was sold for $385, which was a stupendous amount. 1927, paleoanthropologist Davidson Black announces to the Geological Society of China the ancient human fossils from Zhukudian, China, are a new species. And he named it Sinanthropus pekinensis. It's now known as Homo erectus. 1929, the first skull of Peking man found in the caves of Zhukudan, 50 kilometers outside of Peking, China, was roughly dated to 750,000 years ago. 1932, The Adventures of Charlie Chan were first heard on NBC Blue Radio Network. 1939, British Imperial Airways and British Airways merged to form BOAC. 1941, the largest roller skating ring outside of New York City opens in Peekskill, New York. In 1941, Japanese Marshal Admiral Yamamoto sends his fleet toward Pearl Harbor. Isoroku Yamamoto. He led the attack. One of the most senior Japanese Navy officials during World War II. He was commander-in-chief of the combined fleet. An overall command when the Battle of Midway took place, which the Americans inflicted a devastating blow on the Japanese Navy. He was killed by the U.S. Army Air Force when codebreakers identified his flight plan, and his plane was shot down near the Solomon Islands. When he was found, he had his samurai sword between his legs. 1941, American mobster Louis Burkhalter is sentenced to death along with his lieutenants Manuel Luis and Louis Capone. And 1944, the 95th Infantry Division occupies the bridge at Saar. Well, on that note, we have completed our little history segment. We're going to talk more about some of the, what I call the Kennedy hit list. Now, we were talking about the death of Hank Killam, who died March 17, 1964. And he had been running. Nobody's really sure who he was running from. But then it was discovered that William Waters, who died May 20th, 1967, died of a drug overdose, Demerol. There was no autopsy. Mother said Oswald and Killam came to her home before the assassination, and her son tried to talk him out of being involved. Waters talked to the FBI after the assassination, and they told him he knew too much and had to keep his mouth shut. And Killam was also traced to New Orleans, where Jim Garrison, who brought the famed case, contended that three men, including Oswald, planned a Kennedy killing. So, based on all the evidence that came to light regarding Hank Killam, there's no doubt he was murdered, and there was a definite link to the Kennedy assassination. Now, the death of Hank Killam was not only a suspicious death, but it was a blatant case of harassment and then murder due to some extremely sensitive information that the victim quite obviously possessed. And he made no bones about the fact he knew he was going to be killed. He was even aware there was nothing he could do about it, presumably due to the high nature of the people who wanted him dead. At the end, he gave up running, and shortly after he gave up, he got a 3-inch gash on his neck that severed his jugular vein, and then he was thrown through a plate glass window to make it appear that it was an accidental cause of death. Now, the Warren Commission paid no attention to him, but they didn't pay attention to anything that took them away from what they were told they had to come up with, which was a decision that Oswald was the lone gunman. Now, the next victim on the hit list was Gary Underhill. Died May 8, 1964. He was a veteran CIA agent. And his cause of death was a gunshot wound behind the left ear. Official verdict, of course, was suicide. Now, frankly, like Hank Killam, Underhill was running for his life. He predicted his own murder, and he was murdered shortly after that. Now,
The gunshot behind the left ear sounds doable until you figure out that Underhill is actually right-handed. And it'd be extremely awkward, not to mention pointless, for a right-handed person to commit suicide by shooting themselves behind the left ear. There's an experienced CIA operative. If he expressed concerns his life was in danger, there's probably pretty good reason to believe he was correct. Immediately after the assassination of Kennedy, Underhill, to use his own expression, put two and two together and knew exactly who did it. And he even knew that they knew he knew. You know? Hours after the assassination, he fled Washington in fear of his life. When he got to New York, he was very specific in what he said to a close friend. He knew he was going to be killed. He was. Now, for a number of reasons, Underhill firmly believed he was a loose end that needed to be taken care of. His long career as a covert agent with U.S. intelligence is well documented. Some of the official version backers have tried to paint the picture there was no evidence he was CIA, but researchers and authors like James DeEugenio have thoroughly disproven the attempt to hide his connections. Now, Underhill told his friends he was running for his life because he knew who conspired against Kennedy. And what he was specifically describing was a special group within the CIA that was involved in drugs and gun running in Southeast Asia. And he really did know who they were. He also said the Kennedy murder wasn't as cut and dried as it might appear. He said he knew the people involved, and he fled Washington in an attempt to escape. He indicated a small clique within the CIA was actually responsible, and they were conducting a lucrative business in the Far East in gun running and other contraband. He said Kennedy had gotten wind of something going on, so he was killed before he could blow the whistle. He also made mention of a program called Executive Action. Now, that was a special, highly secret CIA military intelligence unit that was actually attempting to assassinate Cuban leader Fidel Castro. And apparently they took time out of their program to take care of Kennedy. Then on June 6, 1964, we had Guy Bannister, private investigator in New Orleans. Cause of death? A heart attack. Official verdict? Natural causes, of course. Now, Bannister was the former head of the FBI Chicago office. He was a rabid anti-communist in general and an anti-Castroist in particular. And he developed a huge and intricate filing system on communist activities, and all his files vanished after he died. It's believed they were seized by unknown, unnamed authorities. Now, authorities assured everyone that cared to listen that there were no inconsistencies in Bannister's death, except for the virtually impossible coincidence that every single witness connected to Guy Bannister and his part of the case died just prior to being sought out in the investigation of their connections to Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, as historian John Simkin observed, Bannister's a key link in the Kennedy assassination.
And he's closely associated with a couple of other key players, David Fieri and New Orleans Mafia boss Carlos Marcello. Now, in 1963, Bannister and David Fieri began working for the lawyer G. Ray Gill and his client Carlos Marcello. Later on, Bannister was linked to the plot to assassinate Kennedy. On August 9, 1963, Oswald distributed leaflets that supported Fidel Castro and his Cuban government. On these leaflets was the address 544 Camp Street in New Orleans. And that was also the office of Carlos Bergoglio, an anti-Castro exile. Now, this leads back to Bannister because his detective agency was virtually part of that same office. Technically around the corner at a different street address, but realistically in the same building and right next door. Bannister's address was 531 Lafayette Street. But it's the same building and had two different addresses. Now, a private investigator employed by Bannister, by the name of Jack Martin, told the district attorney, Jim Garrison, Martin told friends Bannister and Fieri had been involved in the assassination of Kennedy. And according to Martin, Fieri was the getaway man whose job it was to fly the assassin out of Texas. He also claimed that Fieri knew Lee Harvey Oswald from their days in the New Orleans Civil Air Patrol and given him lessons on how to use a rifle to telescopic sight. Now, Fieri became a very popular witness, if you will. Sought for interviews by the FBI and then by Jim Garrison. On November 25th, 3 days after the assassination, Martin was contacted by the FBI and he told him he thought Fieri had hypnotized Oswald into assassinating Kennedy. And it turns out David Fieri was in fact a highly accomplished hypnotist. That information eventually got to Garrison, the DA in New Orleans, and he interviewed Martin about these accusations, and Martin claimed during the summer of 63, Jim Garrison now became convinced. A group of right-wing activists, including Bannister, David Fieri, Carlos Bringer, and Clay Shaw, were involved in a conspiracy with the CIA to kill Kennedy. Now, the links between Oswald and Bannister were very clearly established. They weren't just the matter of Oswald pamphlets having been stored in Bannister's office, as some folks supported the Warren Commission said. Oswald had been in Bannister's office and also seen in Bannister's company and knew each other quite well. Delphine Roberts worked for Bannister and later became his mistress. She told Anthony Summers, the author, that during the summer of 63, Oswald also worked for Bannister. Said she was in the office when Bannister suggested Oswald should establish a local fair play for Cuba committee. Well, now, Garrison interviewed Martin about the ongoings that took place in Bannister's office. And he established that Oswald spent a great deal of time there. Now, in an incredibly convenient coincidence, the sudden deaths of everybody linked to Guy Bannister as well as Bannister himself made it impossible for investigators to determine the extent of his obvious involvement in matters pertaining to the assassination. According to some investigators who were on the scene, Bannister's office was ransacked and a lot of files went missing after his death. Not only was Bannister dead, but as Garrison found out, everybody who was sought in relation to Bannister and his affiliations are also the victims of sudden death. Hugh Ward, Bannister's private investigator, Deslips Morrison, who was the mayor of New Orleans, and Maurice Gatlin, an attorney who was legal counsel to the far-right Minutemen group, with which Bannister was closely associated, all died mysteriously. And then, of course, David Fieri died suddenly at the exact same time he's being sought as an extremely important witness by Garrison. So at the very first serious post-war and commission look at the circumstances surrounding Kennedy's assassination, everybody died. Natural causes, of course. Nothing to look at. Move along. Then on May 22nd, 1964, we have Hugh Ward and Dislis Morris. Dislis Morrison was mayor of New Orleans, and Hugh Ward was a private investigator. They died together in a plane crash. Official verdict? An accident. Nothing to worry about. Except for the virtually impossible coincidence that every witness connected to the same aspect of the case had died suddenly. Now, the pilot, Craig Roberts, was extremely capable. And Ward was also a capable pilot, but something was wrong. They were flying an Aztec. They were flying south on instruments along the Gulf Coast. And they were heard by ranch hands at a ranch east of Ciudad Victoria. The engine just suddenly began sputtering. The unusual factor about the accident is that both engines failed at the same time, and they still had 3 hours of usable fuel on board, which makes it look like sabotage. Then we have attorney Maurice Gatlin, May 28, 1965. He was legal counsel to the Minutemen and also was associated with Guy Bannister. Now, somebody really wanted him dead. He had a heart attack and fell from a sixth-story balcony. Now, what did our paragon of law enforcement say? Natural causes. While attending a meeting of the Inter-American Bar Association in San Juan, Puerto Rico, he was said to suffer a heart attack and fell over the ledge of a six-story balcony. Now, nobody's really sure how this actually happened, and that's all the information anybody could find. He was also another key witness sought by the investigation of District Attorney Jim Garrison. He was a very well-connected attorney who was a fervent anti-communist in league with Bannister. Then we have Earlene Roberts, January 9, 1966. She was the landlady at the rooming house in Dallas where Lee Harvey Oswald lived. Cause of death? Another one of those heart attacks. Official verdict? Natural causes. She was so harassed by the authorities that her relatives believed her health was ruined. So even if her heart attack was from natural causes, you might say it was still caused by her relationship with the Kennedy assassination. Now, she was a nurse, but when she became diabetic, gave up her career and began renting out rooms at her home. She was also an intelligent woman. Now, the case very clearly relates to the Kennedy assassination and was another very obvious case of the powers that be intimidating and harassing a key witness because her testimony didn't fit the official version. Then we have Al Bogard, February 15, 1966. He died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Official verdict was suicide. Now, his involvement was he witnessed Oswald, where the real Oswald couldn't have been. And he was subjected to harassment, which forced him into depression. And they say because he was depressed, he took his own life. Now, he was the car salesman who witnessed Lee Harvey Oswald, who could not drive, test driving a car at high speeds. Now, it seemed like a setup to establish something about Oswald's history. That's part of what the intelligence world calls a legend. Because he made the Oswald that did the test drive made the specific point of talking about Russian, telling Bogart that he couldn't afford the car at the moment, but he was expecting to get a large sum of money in the near future. Then he said maybe he'd go back to Russia to get a car. Based on the evidence, there were a number of conclusions arrived at. Most important was it appeared that he actually did commit suicide. His first cousin found the body, and although he didn't provide information indicating death was something other than suicide, he did say Bogart knew that people were out to get him, and that may be the reason he took his own life. You're not paranoid when they really are out to get you. Then we've got Lee Bowers, August 9, 1966. He died of injuries suffered in an automobile accident. Official verdict, of course, it was an accident. Nothing suspicious to look at. However, eyewitnesses reported Bowers' car was driven off the road by another car. Now, Bowers, who didn't die immediately, was said to have told emergency personnel he believed he'd been drugged along during his stop for coffee just before the crash. Now, he was a very important witness who was in a unique vantage point during the assassination and clearly reported seeing things that contrasted with the official version of events. Now, his testimony is probably the most explosive as any recorded by the Warren Commission. He was one of 65 known witnesses to the president's assassination who thought the shots came from the area of the grassy knoll. But more important than that, he was in a unique position to see some pretty strange behavior in the Knoll area during and immediately before the assassination. He was the tower man with the Union Terminal Company, and he was stationed in his 14-foot tower directly behind the grassy knoll. Because of his job, he faced the assassination site. He could see the railroad overpass to his right front. Right in front of him was a parking lot, and then a wooded stockade fence and a row of trees running along the top of the grassy knoll. What Bowers observed from his unique vantage point, facing down upon the infamous grassy knoll, has fascinated JFK researchers for decades. He made two significant observations, which he revealed to the committee. First, he saw three unfamiliar cars slowly cruising around the parking area in the 35 minutes before the assassination. First two left after a few minutes. Driver of the second car appeared to be talking into a microphone or a telephone. He was holding something up to his mouth with one hand while he was driving with the other. Third car, that had out-of-state plates and mud up to the windows, probed all around the parking lot. Bowers last remembered seeing it about 8 minutes before the shooting. It stopped just above the assassination site. He also saw two unfamiliar men standing on top of the knoll at the edge of the parking lot, about 10 or 15 feet from each other. One man was middle-aged, or slightly older, fairly heavy-set in a white shirt, fairly dark trousers. Another younger man, in his mid-20s, in either a plaid shirt and coat, and plaid coat or a jacket. They were both facing Elm and Houston, with the motorcade to be coming. Well, Bowers was killed when his car left the road and crashed into a concrete abutment in Midlothian, Texas. He was heading west on Highway 67 from Midlothian down to Claiborne, and according to eyewitnesses, were driven off the road by a black car, which sent him into the bridge abutment. He lived for 4 hours after the accident, and during that time was talking to the ambulance people and said he felt he'd been drugged when he stopped for his coffee a few miles back in Midlothian. According to Penn Jones, an author who interviewed him, he is receiving death threats after testifying to the Warren Commission about what he'd seen, and after giving further evidence to attorney Mark Lane, who wrote the book Rush to Judgment. Bowers would have at first insisted that there was nothing suspicious about her husband's death, and finally she made the comment they told him not to talk. Researcher David Welsh reported the attending physician who accompanied Bowers in the ambulance noticed something peculiar about the victim. He said he was in a strange state of shock, different kind of shock than an accident victim experiences. I can't explain it, never seen anything like it. Unsurprisingly, there was no autopsy in the body. Apparently, the body was cremated shortly after he died. Doctors saw no evidence he had suffered a heart attack.
obvious question, which was asked by Geraldo Rivera. Why would Lee Bowers have been killed when it seemed he had already told all he knew? Well, there was an answer for that question. The documentary stated that Bowers confided in his minister he had seen more than he had said publicly. A friend of Bowers named Walter Rochelle told reporters Bowers had been afraid to tell all he actually saw during the assassination. Rochelle said Bowers confided in him with information that was much more specific about the assassins, but he was afraid to go public. He said Bowers disappeared for about 2 days. One night, I know for sure, it was very uncharacteristic of him. When he came back, one of his fingers was missing on one of his hands. He gave his brother some excuse for what happened, but the brother didn't accept it. So he called the local hospitals, the clinics, and some doctor's offices and told there's no record of anybody, certainly not his brother, going in and having that taken care of. Shortly after that, he was killed in that mysterious auto accident. Well, in the end, Monty Bowers, who was Lee Bowers' brother, concluded that Lee's allergies contributed to his death. They were both apparently prone to fits of sneezing. But I would tend to think that if you're driving and you start having a sneezing attack, you're not going to run into a bridge abutment. Well, we've got Marilyn Delilah Wally, who died August 30th, 1966. She was known by her stage names, Delilah and Miranda, as well as Marilyn Moon, Marilyn Magar, and April Wally. She was an exotic dancer who was a regular performer at Jack Ruby's Carousel Club in Dallas. She died of multiple gunshot wounds, shot by her husband, apparently. As a dancer, it was known she witnessed Oswald's presence there on a number of occasions. One was the fact that it was very apparent Oswald and Ruby knew each other. Various people have confirmed that. Now, her murder may well have been just a domestic abuse case, unrelated to the Kennedy assassination, but there's really no way to tell. Like so many other deaths, you've got layer after layer of inconsistencies. Now, this next one is a fascinating case. It involves one of Kennedy's long-running mistresses, Mary Pinchot Meyer. She died October 12, 1964. It's been observed that for a Walker Washington murder, a lot of men in suits and trench coats were certainly on the scene very quickly. One photographer that at the crime scene said the police kept us on the other side of the canal for a long time. She was killed by two gunshot wounds from a .38 caliber at point-blank range. First round was to the back of the head, and the second straight through the heart from the front. Well, the official verdict, an indiscriminate murder while out for her morning run. Factual circumstances are a little bit different than publicly admitted. She was a wife of a high-level CIA officer, and she'd had a very serious affair with Kennedy. And she thought the investigation of Kennedy was a total whitewash and was using her own high-level connections to try to figure out who actually did kill him. Her death caused a frantic search for her diary by the CIA's counterintelligence chief. Now, she was a gifted artist and had an aura of intelligence that men found very attractive. She was married to Cord Meyer in 1945. He was a rising star at the CIA. Her husband became involved in the CIA's organized efforts to sway public opinion through infiltration of U.S. major media and a secret campaign known as Operation Mockingbird. According to Catherine Graham,
publisher of the Washington Post, Cord Meyer, was the principal operative of Mockingbird. According to Cord and Mary Meyer's best friends and companions in Washington, was Ben Bradley, Washington bureau chief for Newsweek, who went on to become editor of the Washington Post. Mary's sister Toni is married to Ben Bradley. So it was a very close-knit group at the peak of the Washington Press Corps. Mary and her husband were close friends with James Angleton and his wife. Angleton was the notorious head of counterintelligence at CIA, and he's the one that went on a frantic hunt for her diary after her death. Now, as Cord Meyer's politics drifted further and further to the right, it became it apparently alienated Mary. She filed for divorce in 1958. Cited extreme mental cruelty as her reason for the court in the court documents. She became certain she was under surveillance after leaving her husband, and her telephone and bedroom were bugged, and she was sure that Angleton was responsible. On several occasions in the summer of 64, she had come home, find that somebody had been in her apartment while she was gone. She reported this to the police, but of course they did nothing. It was known she had an affair with Kennedy, and especially for his track record. It was a much more serious relationship than typically. Now, while Kennedy had many affairs while in the White House, Angleton insisted that the president and Mary Meyer were in love. They had something important. Kennedy did enjoy her company and her intelligent conversation. While it's not known how much of a political nature he shared with her, it's thought to be a great deal. Well, due to her marriage to Cord Meyer, who was involved in media propaganda and was well-traveled in Washington political circles, it was suggested she had President Kennedy's confidence, and he shared things with her he probably shouldn't have. Now, there are a few key points in the assassination of Mary Penshaw Meyer. The unknown victim was pronounced dead at 2:05 p.m. At that point in time, everybody swore they didn't know who she was. Dr. Rayford observed rigor mortis hadn't yet set in, which meant that she couldn't have been dead for more than 2 hours. Her identity wasn't officially learned until about 6 p.m., Prior to 6 p.m., she was only known as an unidentified female murder victim. The killer either knew her or jogged up behind on the exercise path she used. Both shots were point-blank range, 6 inches or less from her body. And she was a strong young lady in good physical shape and wouldn't have let an attacker get that close without screaming for help, fighting him off, or maybe both. Now, the killing was, by all reports, an extremely professional job. She was shot execution style, one shot to the back of the head and one more straight through the heart to make sure she died after she hit the ground. Both shots were lethal and quick, fired from a .38 with apparent precision. This wasn't a casual shooting, but a cold-blooded, up-close, and personal professional hit. Now, she appeared, by all evidence that was gathered, to have been killed by a professional. The first bullet was fired at the back of her head. Of course, she didn't die straight away. Second shot was fired into her heart. Evidence suggests that in both cases, the gun was virtually touching her when it was fired. As the FBI expert testified, the dark holes on the skin around both entry wounds suggest they'd been fired at close range, possibly point blank. Now, Dr. Rayford not only agreed, but amplified concerns that the act was professional, and he noted the presence of the precise kill shot. The second gunshot had been fired with particular precision. The bullet pierced the right lung and severed the aorta. Death would have been instantaneous. According to Dr. Rayford, this suggested expertise, the work of a professional, if you will. The fact she was murdered when leaving her home for her regular exercise routine is also indicative of a professional hit. The gun was never found despite a massive police search. And the search was unprecedented in its scope and manpower, and even used a team of Navy scuba divers to see if it went into the water. The fact she was murdered execution style makes it highly likely it was a professional hit. It wasn't a matter of a crime of emotion or a straight robbery or rape attempt. It was a cold-blooded killer who knew how to perform the deed seamlessly and without emotion. A former CIA cleaner, that's an agent and assassin, later admitted that he had been instructed by the CIA first to survey Mary Meyer and later to assassinate her after he got the contract to terminate her. Officially, his name was William Mitchell, but that was his operational alias. High-level CIA officer named Wistar Janey exhibited clear foreknowledge of the assassination. Ben Bradley wrote that Janey called him from with the news just after lunch, and Wistar Janey also informed Counterintelligence Chief James Angleton well before the victim had even been identified. Well, in an apparent effort to close that case quickly, an innocent man was railroaded into a murder charge by the police and the prosecutor. With a lot of help from the Washington Post and Ben Bradley of Newsweek, both of whom made it clear that the accused was guilty and her murder was an open and shut case. But in actuality, that was far from the truth. Forensic evidence was highly contrary to the motive of robbery or one of sexual assault. In fact, it was absolutely zero forensics evidence linking the accused to the crime. The only thing he was guilty of was being in the vicinity of where the crime took place. Well, if you believe the official version, her diary was destroyed by the CIA, which is technically a felony, the obstruction of justice in the case of a violent death. Angleton and Bradley both lied about the diary. Both men even denied the existence of the diary until it was revealed as true by other sources. They did admit it, they had found the diary, but even then changed their stories about how it was discovered and destroyed. In a statement that defied credibility, Bradley said in an interview for a book he hadn't been aware of Mary's affair with JFK until news of it came out after her murder. Her bloodstained sweater also vanished while in police custody, which precluded advanced DNA testing. Now, in actuality, the case is still listed as an unsolved murder, and it had the same components as the JFK assassination. Self-contradictory crime scene with a patsy that couldn't have possibly committed the act, a rush to judgment, an obvious cover-up, and an apparent unwillingness on the part of authorities to actually uncover the truth. Well, clearly she was eliminated because she knew too much or was in the process of gathering information that would have let her know more than she should. Now, evidence shows the contract to kill her was done at the request of the agency's domestic K office in D.C. If anything, Mr. Janey went too far attempting to marry the highly professional hit on Mary with the exact same type of highly professional operation aimed at JFK. But as far as the fact that Mary was eliminated by the CIA in a job that, as Cord Meyer's personal assistant put it, had all the markings of an in-house rub-out, it's now at this late juncture a proven point. The evidence all points to one thing. The murder and the scene around her murder was orchestrated by the CIA. Yeah, well, a lot of people had a lot to cover up and a lot to lose if she went public with what she knew. And on that note, we've come to the end of today's show. We're going to do one more show about the Kennedy hit list before we go to another topic. Till tomorrow, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.